We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello everyone, I am Ben Johnson and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show where we talk with accomplished chess players, authors, and personalities about their lives, their careers, and how to improve at chess. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters and by Chessable.com. Listeners, as you may have heard, the chess world lost a legend this week. 77-year-old Grandmaster Lubomir Lubich-Kovalik passed away. Grandmaster Kovalik was a top 10 player in the world, an organizer, trainer, and author as well. He grew up in what was then Czechoslovakia, was the two-time national champion there. He eventually emigrated to the U.S. and settled in Northern Virginia. Here in the U.S., he was three-time U.S. champion and a U.S. Chess Hall of Fame member. Unfortunately, I never got the chance to interview Grandmaster Kovalik, but the good news is that friend and former guest of the show, Fred Wilson of Fred Wilson Books, did get to interview him on his interview show that took place in the early 2000s. That interview has been available for Perpetual Chess Patreon subscribers behind the paywall for a while now, but I'm going to share it with you all ad-free here once I'm done with this introduction. GM Kovalik witnessed so much chess history, and he talks about it a lot in this great interview. As he discusses, he worked with Bobby Fischer in Iceland during the match of the century against Spassky. He worked with Grandmaster Nigel Short leading up to his challenging Kasparov for the World Championship in the early 1990s, when that's Short challenging Kasparov. He discusses the ups and downs of that experience in some detail in his interview with Fred. Lubich Kovalik talks about his chess beginnings, his favorite chess book. So there's a lot to enjoy in this interview. You also get a sense for his sense of humor. So I think you'll enjoy this interview. And if you do, please consider subscribing to the Perpetual Chess Patreon page to hear the rest of Fred Wilson's great archive of interviews. The archive's actually only going to be available for a few more months, but it's all there to download right now, including early 2000s era interviews with GM Vishy Anand, GM Arthur Bisguire, GM Alex Vojkovich, Bruce Pandolfini, Maurice Ashley, so many more. So without further ado, please enjoy this Fred Wilson interview with GM Kovalik. And this is from September 3rd, 2003. And I will catch you guys all next week.
Hi, folks. Fred Wilson back. I'm very proud and happy to have my guest, Lubomir Kovalik. I believe you like to be called Lubash, correct?
Well, it's a sort of nickname, yes.
Okay, well, Lubash, thank you very much for being on the show. And I like to start off especially asking successful and very strong players questions about their beginning. Like, how old were you when you learned how to play?
Well, it's such a long time ago that I almost don't remember, but I do. I was 11. That is quite late for in today's standards. Yes, that.
That's late for a grandmaster.
Well, yeah, that's true. But I was rather fast developing, so I made up.
Okay, so let's see. If you by the way, congratulations on your 60th birthday.
And, oh, thank you very much. Yeah.
it means if you were born in 1943, that you learned in 1954.
Yes, that's right. Yes, in the summer.
And were you like taught by a parent or a friend or?
No, that was in school. That was on a soccer field when I got beaten up. When I kicked a ball into a chessboard where two kids played, but they were stronger than me, and they were very angry that I have destroyed their position. So I said, well, if you need to fight for your game so hard, then teach me the game. So that's what happened.
Oh, that's an amazing and charming story. Did you find, I would assume you caught on very quickly how the pieces move and capture and so forth. But now here's a question that I like to ask masters and grandmasters. Did you find that you particularly had to study tactics early, like most of us, or that very early on you were seeing 3 to 5 play, you know, within 5 or 6 months of beginning the game?
Well, I was pretty good in tactics. That was one of my strong qualities. I was very lucky, actually, when I started to play the game, that across the street lived a boy by the name Michal Janata that was in Prague, and perhaps you may remember that in 1963 he tied for first in the World Junior Championship with Georgiou. And he started to play chess since 6, so he was well ahead, but we, because of him, we just built a very strong team in the school, and we won the championship in Prague. As far as tactics goes, we played a lot of gambits, and the tactics just became very natural to us. He was more positional player. I was always sort of, I like some mixed up, tactical mixed up.
Well, I mean, your most famous games, from whether it's against Gufeld or Portisch or whoever, are tactical, chaotic masterpieces. And it must have been very draining, but no one plays like that who doesn't like it, doesn't enjoy it. And I was thinking...
This is a very interesting topic, what you just said. It's, I have seen many players who played very sharp and combinational chess, like Albin Planinc or Draško Velimirović, to name two great Yugoslav attacking grandmasters, and even Bruno Parma, who was World Junior Champion at one time. They spent so much energy on these games that they simply, Planinc had to leave the game, basically, and Parma did the same.
Parma, I think, became an attorney or a lawyer or something like that. But Planinc he doesn't play anymore at all. He was a very exciting player in the 1970s.
Yes, exactly. Well, remember, in 1973, he won the tournament in Amsterdam with Petrosian. I was third. Boris Paskey was fourth at that time. So he was an excellent player, and he had many new ideas in the openings and in the middle game.
But he just sort of burned out.
Burned out, right.
Is he still alive?
That I don't know. That I don't know. This is, I suppose so, but I'm not so sure. He was not that old. I mean, he could be still around.
Well, it's interesting. Velimirovich still plays, but not with the success that he had in the 70s. But he still tries to mate people, as far as I can see.
What?
He still tries to just checkmate people from the get-go.
Yes. This was always his style, and he was always very dangerous. And in 1965 in Belgrade, I became one of his victims in a game. I think it was a Felidor defense, which was a brilliant game he played and defeated me. This was, by the way, an interesting tournament for an encounter with Lubomir Lubojevic. That was the premier Yugoslav player after Grigoric, as you know. He was a very young boy. I think he was 13 or 14 at that time. And, I always noticed that he would come to my board and he would demonstrate the moves on the big demonstration board. And there were others, other boys, but he always chose this one. And I didn't know about this, basically. And that was only maybe 20 years later he told me that he was the one who did it. And he said, I always fought with the other boys to demonstrate your game, because you always run out of cigarettes and you send me for cigarettes and you gave me a big tip.
And here you thought it was because he wanted to watch your chat.
Well, no, he was very fast, actually. You know, when you had seen him demonstrate, he was ahead of time, and he was already, you could see some promising talent.
Actually, in talking about promising talent, you have another interesting description of the evolution of Czechoslovakian chess after the war. It's that after the war, the primary players were Pachman and Philippe, and Pachman was the great theoretician. You suggested Philippe was more of a natural player, less of an opening study maniac. But three of you came along in succession that Matt had to eventually successfully challenge them. And, you know, one was yourself, and one was Hort, and the other was Schmeichel. Am I saying that correctly?
Yes, Schmeichel was he's three years younger than me. So he came when we were young, you were teenagers, you know, the three years difference is a big difference. So basically, Bachmann was the theoretician at that time. Another was Dr. Max Euwe in Holland. And he published the Chess Archive, the opening series. Bachmann published a four volume of opening theory and also middle game and tactics and end games. But Philip was a good theoretician, but he was a more natural player. He had a very good sense for positions and for the pieces, and he would apply a lot of pressure on your positional pressure. And of course, he was the most successful Czech player if we talk about World Championship qualifications, because he twice made it to the candidates tournament in 1956 in Amsterdam, and in 1962 he played in Curaçao, where Bobby Fischer played, of course. Mm-hmm. Then there was 20 years nothing. There was some kind of pause before the before we started to come on, and that was not only Hort, myself, and Schmeichel. There was also Janza, and there was also Janata, and Trappel, who was called the Czech Tal. He was a very exciting player when we were young, and you know, there was a big group of talented players, and of course Smejkal could have gone perhaps quite far if he didn't have the illness. He had something with his brain, and he could not play chess after 1973. Just for 3 years, he was totally out of it. So if he didn't have this kind of accident, I suppose he was one of the most brilliant positional players, you know, Czech players. Mm-hmm. Hort was sort of scrambling. He could, he always, when he was young, he didn't know any theory. So he was always on defensive. He was defended, and then he had some kind of will, power, you know, to fight back, and that's what made him very strong. And Smejkal knew his stuff. He just and he was a very good positional player.
This is very interesting. I guess the new generation begins with perhaps Vitajnik.
Yes, that was Vtáčnik was after that. This was a player I didn't really know until I came with Mark Diesen to the Junior World Championship in Holland in Groningen in 1976-77. That was during the new year, and actually Vtáčnik was very helpful to Mark, because I think in the middle of the tournament he stopped fast-driving Vladimirov. Yevgeny Vladimirov was also second of Kasparov. He used to be a spy for Karpov, if you remember these
right, I do, yeah.
Matches. So he was then already quite a big talent, and he started something like 6 out of 6, and then somewhere Vtáčnik beat him. And it depressed him, and Mark just was able to come on top afterwards.
Well, you may be interested to know that Mark is kind of unretired. He's doing a show for chess.
Yes, this is very good that he is back in chess. Yes, yes, I noticed this with pleasure.
Oh, okay, because I think John Fedorovich told me that of that whole crowd. Back then, Fed Christensen, Mark Diesen, Michael Rode, Ken Reagan, the whole bunch, that he thought Diesen was really the most talented.
Well, he was also, he had a very good sense for the pieces. There was not the big bang, you know, games with Mark, but he applied a very strong positional pressure, and at that age, I think that's what made him... slightly better than you know, his colleagues when he was winning the U.S. Junior Championships.
And okay, well, I forgot, for you served as his trainer also before later on.
Yes, I was asked. There was a program under Ed Edmondson. He basically liked to pick up some talents and give them some kind of education, so to speak. Because Mark lived here in the Washington DC area, this was a natural combination that we would meet. I think later on, under the same program, I was supposed to train Michael Wilder. At least he said he picked me up, but I don't know. But I worked with Mark for about two years, and then I went with him to Groningen when he played the World Championship.
Must have been very gratifying that somebody you're teaching wins a world or a national championship.
This was quite nice. Yes, yes.
But let's get back to you. The things that influenced you as an adolescent, growing up, I guess, in Prague. What literature do you remember reading that influenced you then, and maybe you can even tell us what are some of your favorite books that have come out over the last 10 years or so?
Well, in the 1950s, when I was starting up, there were not so many books except Bachmann's books were quite popular, and he was just starting. in the 50s to publish these books. I was sort of privileged when I was 15, and at that age I almost won the adult championship of Prague. I lost last two games and finished second by half a point or something like that. But he invited me to participate in some group training he had with the members of the Czechoslovakian student team for student Olympiads. And what we did, we were just looking on the tournament games. There were probably in those days maybe 10 to 12 major tournaments you would like to know about. And so we analyzed these games. I also did some work on positions where in his first volumes he would say the position is unclear, so we were cleaning it up and for the next volumes and so on. So this was the major influence. Then we were getting some stuff from Soviet Union, some magazines, Shakhmatny Bulletin, and the Russian books were quite inexpensive, so we were able to gain that. Then later we were getting the chess archive as far as the opening goes. I was basically very versed in openings, and I played almost anything there was, any kind of openings, just for fun and kicks.
Did you play both E4 and D4 when you were young, or were you more just an E4 player until you got older?
I was E4, but I was also, I played English, I played Red, I played D4. I played everything. This was, it was just fun. You know, those days in the 50s and maybe even early 60s, you could do this. You didn't have to specialize. It was not like, you know, you have so much information these days, and there could be a danger around every corner, every move, and you have to basically acknowledge that, you know, you have to narrow your ambitions in the opening. So, but those days we could play almost anything, and I did, and I think this is what helps you to develop as a player. So you get all kind of different positions from different openings, and it's more fun. It's like, you know, if you play the exchange variation of Rui Lopez or the on second move C3 against the Sicilian, well, okay, you can live, but it's boring.
I see what you're saying. So the information explosion may contribute to people almost specializing too much. They don't experiment enough.
Well, there were specialists in the 60s also. For example, in 1963, I played a zonal tournament with Portish and Bent Larsen. And Portish used to, I was noticing that he used to come to tournaments in a very different way. So, for example, he would come to one tournament and he would choose only the French against E4. Then in the next tournament, he would play Sicilian Paulsen. And then next tournament, he would play E5 against E4. So this way, he just kept current with a lot of opening theory. And it was possible because there were not so many tournaments and not so many games or important games to remember. I remember in 1965, the Yugoslavs started a year afterwards, I mean, in 1966, they started what is known now the Chess Informant. But in 1964, 65, They were playing matches against Soviet Union, and Yugoslavia and Soviet Union in those days were the two leading chess countries. And they have published some kind of booklet of very important games, what happened in the last year, as a preparation against the Soviets. And then later on, they tried to commercialize this. They published a little booklet, but it was a larger booklet. And from that, that was the pre-informant book, and then it became Chess Informant, which is now read worldwide.
I think I remember. It looks like it's almost a mimeograph thing with about 500 or 600 games.
Yes, yes, exactly.
And it's the precursor of Informant. It's like it covers 1964-65, and it's
right.
It looks like an Informant before Informant, and I've seen it. It's an interesting collection of games too.
Yes,
Not all of them get in the database. Well, except for your database. In fact, maybe we should move on to that. You were involved in one of the assaults on Mount Kasparov. You were Nigel Short's trainer, I guess, for a year and a half or 2 years.
And well, yes, 3 years. Yes.
3 years.
Yes.
You helped him beat, I think, Spielman?
Well, first of all, I was asked to be his second in the for the Manila Interzonal.
That's 1990. Right.
That's where we started. We started basically here in April 1990. He would come, he would fly here. He had some sponsor too.
I might tell people that Lubash lives in Reston, Virginia, and has for many years, I guess maybe 25 years or so. And you have a nice home, and it's kind of a peaceful, quiet place to study and work.
Yes, yes. Well, we have moved here in 1974. So, we are quite happy here because the place is, when I was having a playing career, when I played more tournaments, this was a good place to come back and rest and, get new energy for games. So in 1990, I was asked by Nigel Short if I would work with him, and we went to Manila, where he basically he had to win the last game against Gurevich, that's now the Belgian, Michael Gurevich.
It's a very famous game. Maybe you should describe even your preparation for it and his approach to it. He had to win with black.
That's right, yeah. That's what he had to do. And like Mark Diesen in the last game in Groningen in 77, in January, Nigel was sort of panicking too. He didn't know what to do. And there was the problem was that Gurevich played one variation over and over again with d4 and so on. And Nigel didn't know what to do. And I showed him a little trap where he could have trap Gurevich queen if it went that way. It really doesn't matter. You know, whether the trap is good or not. When you are coaching, you do basically a lot of things to bring confidence to your player. And that sort of made Nigel happy and he stopped thinking negatively about the game. And then when Gurevich played d4, Nigel played e6, that was then, and Gurevich went for the French, which he doesn't play too often. And on the third move, he chose the exchange variation. And it was still not his position, and he got terribly outplayed. Also, he was one of the leading players in the world at that time, maybe in the top 10 or 15 for sure. But he was quite well outplayed. And it's quite interesting what happened. And since that, the career of Nigel Short rocketed up, and Gurevich could not move forward. It was just basically one game decided his career.
It's interesting, Lubach, that Andy Soltis about a year ago wrote a column saying basically the same thing. One game can destroy a man's career.
Well, if you let it, if you don't have strong character to fight it.
Apparently, he's making a small comeback. He seems to be very good in quick chess, Gurbic.
Yes, well, he's a very strong player, but I think that as far as world championship ambitions and so on, I think that's gone. That's not there anymore.
No, I would fully agree. And he went for a Drosh variation, but one, even as a grandmaster, he wasn't that familiar with how to play this relatively simple position.
Yeah, it was in exchange French, but okay, so you get a slightly worse bishop, and but you still play. But then, you know, a lot of factors come into play, and Nigel was sort of, you know, in a free spirit, and Gurevich knew there was a pressure because, you know, if he lost, then he would be out of it. So there are a lot of factors which play a role during an important game. That was very important for Nigel.
Well, then Nigel retained you now that he's in the World Championship matches. And I think he beat Spielman.
Well, yes. Afterwards, he went to. This was actually the decision, you know, to work with me was that in the last World Championship qualification, he got beaten by Spielman, and so then he was supposed to play him again, and so we started to work on it, and in that match there was a. Well, I can oversimplify this, but let's say Spielman is a diagonal player. He likes to put bishops on the diagonals and so on. So I basically invented a strategy of his own medicine, and I taught Nigel the Greenfield Indian where he would have the bishop on a long diagonal, and then, you know, Jonathan would have to look at it and would hate it, basically. And this is what happened. This was basically that he got the diagonal treatment in the match. And it was always in a match there is some kind of break point. There was a situation where Nigel was almost giving up, but fortunately he didn't. And then in the playoff, he outplayed Spielman. So that was
his breakthrough to being able to beat Karpov and Timon. I think
he made I think in 1991 he faced Boris Gelfand in Brussels.
Right.
And that was an interesting match because Gelfand brought all the theoreticians like Khalifman and Usman and so on. There was the Belarusian team known for some good opening knowledge, plus Khalifman, as I mentioned, that he is also quite well-known theoretician. And Nigel worked on one particular variation against the Neidorf is John Nunn. It was the move F4 they started to work on it. And and they had some kind of disagreement, which I find out during the first game, that when they were looking at this variation, John wanted to play one move and Nigel wanted to play a different move. And Nigel lost terribly. And so I forbid him to play the open Sicilian. I switched him into the Grand Prix attack, and Gelfand got beaten terribly in that game, and he never touched the Sicilian defense again, which was very important because he started to play. He played the Berlin defense in Spanish, but that was not his style. Basically, we threw him away from his strengths and then Nigel was able to win the match. So sometimes it's important to take, you know, the main weapon from your opponent.
Well, I know, if you're able to do it. This sounds like Garry Kasparov would say that you beat Gelfand with the not the principal variations, but Gelfand wasn't able to cope with the less principled variations. You guys made the decision. You're going to go at his knight off and try and beat it. You're not going to try and beat him with the Grand Prix attack, the closed Sicilian, any. Nigel had a funny name for them. It wasn't shady. It was like hokey or a funny English term he used for the anti-Sicilian systems outside of the open Sicilian.
Well, no, I basically it doesn't matter. You want to go to the match with a few options, and this is obvious. You know that. There is a different way of coaching. There are guys who prepare quite well. They invent training positions. This is Dvoretsky's main strength, basically. But when it comes to matches, when you need a little psychology and switching at the right moment and seeing that, you know, the way you are going is not exactly the way you should, and looking what your opponent is doing and applying different tactics, that is a different type of coaching, which I think I was successful with Nigel, that sometimes I would, and he was very good at this, I have to admit, because he was willing to take on new openings. He was willing to learn, you know, everything new. He learned in the course of these 3 years, Grünfeld in the end. And,
well, I forgot that. The Nigel is basically a kind of Queen's Gambit Decline Nimzo Indian player.
Yes, this is true. And when we had openings for each player, so for example, against Karpov, it was the Queen's Gambit accepted.
Uh-huh.
Except, you know, sometimes you calculate, I had some kind of rules and so on, that, for example, you cannot play three times the opening because you would be sort of detected, the weaknesses will be detected and so on. So you have to switch. So we figured out that we have... with Karpov, one game to give him. It sounds funny, but so we said, well, one opening, something crazy. Okay, we can try. It doesn't matter because otherwise my rule would not work. So we had chosen the Budapest Gambit.
and
we gave him the present in the first game, basically.
Right. It's probably, well, at least you found out it might be the wrong guy to try that again.
He just sort of knew it. The game was not so clear for some time. But basically, if there is one free opening or game where you don't have, you know, you can sort of try whatever you want, that was it. And the Budapest Gambit was not very, not quite bad. I think it's interesting gambit, but
it also may have confused them. Then they go home to study the Budapest, but they never see it again.
Yeah, this is true. That's another way, you know, how to do it. But of course, in all these matches, luck plays a big role, and I can tell you perhaps the secret behind Nigel's victory in against Karpov. It was at one point I have noticed that we may be running out of openings if he starts to play e4, and I said, well, Nigel, maybe, you know, we can try something like the Sicilian Rouser, and you know, I played it against Karpov in Bugoino, and I got good position, but I lost later on. That was not fault of the opening. But I thought that, you know, he he would not feel quite comfortable there. So I was, I basically asked him to look at the Poděbrady variation, knight b3 in the Sicilian Rouser, and he was sort of studying it, and we were looking on games and so on from the black's point of view. Now, Karpov, okay, they played again the match, and Karpov is down by 1 point. There is the last tense game. He's black, and Nigel comes to the board and plays e4, and suddenly comes Sicilian, and he plays straight into the Poděbrady variation with the black pieces, which Nigel at that moment knew what is the best, and so on, because he studied it with reverse color. So this is an extreme luck, which you could not, you know, predict. I think that it was Yepyshyn, Vladimir Yepyshyn, who basically convinced Karpov that this is a good way to try it. But unfortunately, he was unlucky because of the situation we had here in Reston.
Well, that's very, very interesting. So he walked right into, he played something Nigel himself was considering playing under certain circumstances.
Yes, Nigel was considering to playing with black, and suddenly Karpov plays the same thing with black. So Nigel knew what were these dangerous moments and dangerous lines, and so he just...
Well, actually, he crushed Karpov in that game, as I remember.
Well,
sort of,
yes. There were some moments which were tricky, but at least, you know, this is a such a big psychological advantage. I was looking at him, he almost laughed, you know, he almost fell from the chair when he saw what Karpov was doing. And that gives you tremendous confidence in the game. It's a decisive game. You play with, you know, with fun, basically. And the pressure is off because you know that you know a lot of things about the variation, and you know more than Karpov knew.
Very interesting. I want to just, before we go to a commercial break, and then we're going to take questions to you via the ICC, and also, Alex Baburin had some questions he wanted me to ask you, which we'll get to in a little while. There's an interesting book, it's out of print now, called Endgame by Dominic Lawrence, by Dominic Lawson, who was this journalist who claimed to be a friend of Nigel Short. And he paints such a scathingly honest picture of Short and how Short behaved under the pressure of these matches, and particularly the match with Kasparov, that I think you pointed out to me that Hans Reis said, with friends like him, if this is how he treats his friends, I don't want to be that man's enemy. And I think you might want to contradict a few things that he says in the book, but you finally had a falling out with Short, or they let you go, they fired you. But it seems to, it's not clear from Lawson's account what really happened. You're preparing for 4 months with Nigel. In the last month, he's getting itchy, and he wants to bring in more help, more contrast, perhaps. So he brings in Spielman. And then finally, for perhaps a counterweight to Spielman's kind of wild, anything is possible approach, he brings in Hubner, the great theoretician. So Lawson puts it well. He says he has the orthodox grandmaster of great talent and the anarchist grandmaster of great talent. And I guess you're somewhere in between. You're really a coach by now, a great coach. And neither one of these people is a coach. And something happened that led to a falling out after the first two or three games in the match. And maybe you can talk about that a little, because I don't think you're treated fairly in this book. In the book, they claim that you were just hanging out with Milos Forman and not really watching the first two games. I find that impossible to believe. Because
Dominic Lawson is, of course, a very, very good writer. He is the son of Nigel Lawson, who was the finance minister of Britain under Margaret Thatcher. Mm-hmm. And so he runs into high society there, and he is currently the editor-in-chief of the Sunday Daily Telegraph. He was running before he was the editor-in-chief of the Weekly Spectator, which is a very interesting weekly magazine. With sort of essays and so on. But he always was a good friend of Nigel. And he was also, he came to Reston and he had seen a lot of things. I have to correct, this was my suggestion because Nigel said, well, maybe the world championship match, I need some more people, you know, to help me. It's a big thing, so it was my suggestion to bring in Robert Huebner because I was his second in 1973 when he played Smyslov in Austria. Perhaps you remember that the match was decided by roulette.
It was really actually a disgusting resolution to a chess match.
Well, you know, that's...
another story.
No, that's another story. But anyway, so, and Jonathan Spielman was there, and he has some interesting ideas, of course, in chess, so he's an interesting player. So this was basically the team. The fallout was not because of, I don't know, because of chess matters. I think that the problem was that the match was not played under the conditions which they wished to be played. Finally, there were less money offered to them, and they were under pressure either to play the match or just get some money and not to play it at all. And of course, that would be very bad for their image. So they decided to play under less money. So there was, of course, less money also for the seconds and so on. So that was the main problem. But I was never told this openly.
The book I think misrepresents this. It claims that Nigel and his wife were getting annoyed with you because you weren't giving enough time to. Analysis before and after games. And knowing you, I find that hard to believe. I also note one funny thing, that Kasparov tested Short, found out Short was going to play the Marshall counterattack. And then you had prepared him with an anti-Marshall line way in advance, and he played a different anti-Marshall line, which did not serve him well. And apparently there was controversy among you versus Nigel and the others about what line to play against, you know, Kasparov's anti-Marshall attack line, the A4 stuff. And
this is probably getting into details, what I did since Nigel beat Timan in February and it was known that he would play Kasparov. He came here right away, and then we started preparation. And I think that the idea I had to employ the move 6, bishop c4, the Fischer variation against Neidorf, as the main weapon was correct, and he got many good positions there.
That led to the most exciting games in the match.
Yes, and it's perhaps even the most exciting game of the decade, which ended in a draw, by the way. Of course, we know, this is a different story. Nigel had a lot of ideas against the anti-Marshall. But the problem was that Kasparov employed Geller's move, which was not to be expected. The move was to play knight from b1 to d2, and then switch it to f1 and e3 or g3. That was what Yefim Geller, a great theoretician, basically taught Kasparov. And this was nature because, in principle, he didn't like these closed Spanish games. Then he didn't really know what to do there. And by the time, you know, I was by the time something could be done, it was too late, and I was gone from London.
Well, I personally think they missed you.
Well, it's difficult to say because I think that Nigel's mind was not really on the match. I think that he sort of realized that it was as far as he could go, and of course he would like to play, you know, better. But it was he was sort of down already somehow. There was a bit pressure on him, and. Yeah, the 1 week I spent there with him, that was it was not like in the matches before. Just to, you know, to say it very shortly.
Well, okay. Well, I'm very nice to get your version of events. We do know that your advice to attack Kasparov in his favorite openings almost worked, and. I have a theory, Lubash, and I'll just run it by you because I was thinking about it today and I couldn't get it out of my mind. You know, it's well known that Korchnoi advised someone that the only way to beat Kasparov is to take out his Sicilian. And it may indeed, Lubash, be that no one can take out his Sicilian. But the man who beat Kasparov took out his King's Indian and then took out some of his other defenses. And so maybe the only way to beat a Kasparov is to play d4.
Well,
I mean, I'm asking your opinion about that sort.
No, this is true, but I think that Kasparov already was sort of discarding King's Indian after b4. You know, the bayonet attack was sort of worrying him. And it's true, there were not only games against Kramnik, but he was getting some positions. And I can tell you as a King's Indian player that, you know, you take chances, you take risk, you are cramped, and maybe there are one or two moments where you can just jump out of it, that you get the chance to get counterplay and so on. You have to feel these chances. If you miss it, then, there's a big problem. So Kasparov basically decided that why should he take this risk when he can play games where he could get more space, and then later on he could equalize, and then started to play for win. So he became wiser basically. and with the Sicilian, I think that Nigel had a very good chance because he's tactically quite good, and you could notice that Kasparov overlooked some tactical shots. Let's say in the Scottish game, you know, in one game and so on. So I sort of judge that it's not such a bad idea to give Nigel attacking positions. That's what, you know, we went for. And the Sicilian bishop c4 with the connection of short castle and queen f3, that gives you some kind of positional pressure you put the pressure with pieces, of course. You don't use pawns, but this was very, very good, and it put Kasparov under more pressure than he was used to. So I think this was a good choice. I think that it's not possible to, if you play e4, to to prevent Kasparov to play Sisian unless you glue the pawn on c7 for him.
Well, Lubash, on that funny note, we're going to go away, Lubash, but you stay with us. Don't go anywhere.
Okay.
You can have a drink of water or a coffee or a sip of wine, but stay at the phone. We're going to go away for a break for 2 or 3 minutes, and then we'll be back, and I would hope that people will email lots of questions via ICC to Tony Rook for Lubash Kovalik, and have about 45 minutes for Lubash to answer questions about his career and anything else you want to ask him in chess. I believe Lubash at one time was one of the top 10 players in the world on the rating list. So this is a man with a great deal of experience, and he was and probably still is a great attacking player. Before we take questions over ICC, Tony, I have a couple of questions that Alex Baburin, who is next week's guest, emailed me to ask Lubash. And this is an interesting question, Lubash, and it's probably because Alex is an emigre himself, of course. He's gone, you know, from Russia to Ireland. He's an Irish citizen. He said, did chess help you to adapt to the new country when you first moved to Germany and then to the USA, or would it have been better to have a normal profession? And he puts that in quotation marks, normal.
Well, okay. That's this is quite interesting, because when I left Czechoslovakia, that had to be done. This was no doubt about this. So I spent 2 years in Germany. And my only tool at that time was chess to make a living. I wouldn't be, you know, I didn't even know German at that time. I had to learn it. But then I made a very conscious decision to come here and to study. And I even got a job, a radio job, strangely enough, with the Voice of America. And so I had a job, and it was only after Bobby Fischer won the match against Paskin in Reykjavik. Then I decided, with the help actually of the dean of the faculty, Slavic faculty, what I was studying. He basically said, if someone is number one or number two in this country, he has to do what he does best. So I advise you not to become a professor of Slavic literature, but just play chess. So I still didn't listen to him. I was working for 1 year, and then in 1973 I decided basically to become a professional player. And and of course, this is a funny story. Of course, it's mentioned in some quizzes about chess. When I was on my way to the United States, I stopped in Caracas in Venezuela where I played an international tournament. I played the first few rounds, I don't know how many, 6, 7, 8, under the Czechoslovakian flag, and I think that then Ed Edmondson called the organizers and asked them to put an American flag there, and the reason was that in case an Olympiad was in June, so I could be eligible. So I was basically playing for the United States before I even settled here. And so to answer Alexander's question, I think that I had to play chess in Germany. This was quite clear. Or in Europe, I was not only playing in Germany, but everywhere in Europe for 2 years. But here I made a choice to try something else, and then I decided chess is the profession I would like to pursue. So that's how I ended. I think that whether I had another profession, I might be quite unhappy about that, looking back.
Well, in other words, you don't regret becoming a professional chess player.
No, not at all. No.
Chess trainer and chess author.
No, no.
Well,
this is, you know, this has been a happy almost 50 years. It's I'm sort of proud to be involved with chess. It's a great game, and the nice thing about it is that every day you can find some new idea and beautiful things which sort of keeps you going from day to day, and there's so much material and so many ideas that it's wonderful to be, you know, involved in the game.
Fully agree, Lubasha. Most days my routine is to get up, make a strong cup of coffee, and look at chess for an hour in the morning. Like my most pleasant hour on many days. It's whether I'm looking at Nguyen Chess, your book, 1975 Wyckoff Z, anything I haven't looked at before.
You know that some people do this before they have breakfast.
I just have coffee. I eat later.
Okay.
One more question from Alex Baburin, and then we'll take questions from Tony Rook via ICC. What was your most pleasant and enjoyable tournament, and what was the worst?
This is very difficult. I think that we were blessed that we played chess in 1970s. Hans Rey, the Dutch grandmaster, called it the golden era of chess, and probably he's right. There were wonderful tournaments and wonderful places. Life was slightly slower than it is now. There were several nice tournaments. I think in 1973, perhaps, the tournaments in the Philippines were very nicely organized.
Did you win Manila 73?
Yes, I finished third behind Larsen and Lubojevic. That was the tournament where Bobby Fischer opened this a nine-move game against President Marcos. That was the tournament which was also played in the Araneta Coliseum, where Muhammad Ali boxed with Frazier back in, later in 1975. Mm-hmm. We came a little bit earlier, so we were invited to the presidential palace and spent evenings with the president, first lady, and Bobby, and so on. So it was quite interesting. You know, it's
What was your worst tournament? We all have bad ones.
That could be Manila 75.
Okay.
You know, that was really bad. Especially the trip back, because it took something like with typhoons and some repairs of the airplane and so on. It took me 56 hours to go from Manila to Washington, D.C.
Oh, my God.
And I was smoking quite heavily at the time, and I quit smoking because of that.
So wait, maybe that was one of your best tournaments.
No, because...
You quit smoking.
Yes, but the point was that in the year afterwards, we played also in Manila. That was the Interzonal in 1976. I went there with Jan Timman, was my second. And the tournament was going sort of funny, but it didn't matter. On the way back, when we were flying to San Francisco, we got hit by lightning, and the plane shook so terribly that I said, "Well, okay, let me have a smoke." So I stopped smoking, and in San Francisco, I already bought a carton, and so
now.
I was smoking till 1983 when I definitely quit, so I have an anniversary now, 20 years of not smoking.
Okay, well, you and I are in the same boat, Lubas. I'm 57 and I quit in 1983.
Oh, okay.
And so that's probably the reason we feel well today.
Yeah.
Okay, but so now we're both vehemently against smoking, but Tony, we have questions via ICC, not about smoking, but about chess for Lubot.
We do. Our first question is from Groot. And Groot's question is, okay, Lubosch, in 1968 U.S. Championships, you disdained a quick draw from Kim Commons and played a real fight. A similar thing happened in the U.S. Championships between Shabalov and Akopian. What is your take on quick draws, and what are your thoughts about those games?
Okay, so just to correct the date, it was 1978, not 68.
Oh.
68, I was still in Czechoslovakia. But anyway, I think with the game with Kim Commons, I sort of had to play for win because I was chased by a very talented player, was Grandmaster Jim Turgeon, and I need that point quite badly. So, but I think that's not the point. The question is, the question is about draws. And well, what's to say about the draw? I was often I would be punished for making draws. There were tournaments where I had a lot of wins. It's as long as there is the rule that draw could be made by a verbal agreement during the game, it's very difficult to prevent it. I remember when, you know, all these periods when they were trying to make players fight, where they were inventing, they were offering money, they were trying to force players to play 40 moves and all kind of things. And I think the answer is, well, there could be several answers, but one of them is, which was told to me by one world champion who said, well, if we really want to make a draw, our technique is so high that even if one of us drops a queen, we will be able to make a draw. But of course, in the book on 1975 on Vacanze, I have mentioned this this theory of Mikhail Botvinnik, the world champion. Of course, he said that sometimes when you have a very hectic and long games where you spend a lot of energy, a draw could contribute to some future creative efforts. In other words, I think it's nice to fight. You know, I was on both sides of the coin. And then I was in a tournament in 1975 when I had a book deadline in Teesside, and I drew all my games, which was not the record. I think Dr. Trifunovic, the Yugoslav grandmaster, once on my eyes finished with 15 draws in a tournament, all 15s. But I am not proud of it. But sometimes, you know, there are circumstances like. In 75, I put so much energy into this book on Vacanze that I was unable to play later on, even the U.S. Championship, any sparks and so on. I don't think, you know, it is that you can't do much about this. Of course, it will be nice to fight, but... players have a choice. Either they show some kind of creativity and fighting, and they will be invited to major tournaments, or they don't, and they, you know, make deals and so on. And so they basically take themselves out of nice tournaments. At least it used to be like that.
Well, it's interesting, Lubosch. I mean, you're saying that the marketplace will... will judge certain players by their fighting spirit and perhaps compensate them more highly.
Well, it used to be, you know, in the 70s, you know, players were invited to tournaments on the basis of their creativity. Sometimes, of course, you had to win some titles and so on, but you know, exciting players are always welcome. So I think in some kind of qualifications, you don't have much choice. You have to take everybody, no matter what you know, his way of is.
Sure, but I can see that the big money tournaments, the Dortmund, Linares, they can pick and choose amongst who they please. I suspect that's why Bolingon got an invitation. He is known as a fighter. Oh, he's number 42 in the world.
Who?
Vikman Bolingon.
Oh, yes.
I think he got an invitation because he's known as a big
no,
fighter.
No. He got into Dortmund because he won the Moscow Open.
That was
the qualification.
So he earned his way in.
Pardon?
He earned his way in.
Yes. That was the idea to bring the winner of Moscow Open. But, you know, in Linares, that is, this is sort of ridiculous. You know, I was fighting for open prizes, basically. Was one of my idea when I organized Montreal, for example, in 79, and then World Cup in 87. The prizes were shown, and how much it was, and so on. Linares, people get fees to play, and you could see that first place is $7,000, which is ridiculous, because most of the money is paid in starting fees and so on. But this is something else, of course.
Well, it sounds like they're working at cross purposes to what they really want. Maybe they should just say first place is $50,000 or $75,000, and you get no appearance fees, and you know, if you don't want to come, fine. But sure, some people will show up who want to play for that money.
Yeah, well, this is true, of course, but some players, they prefer not to mention, you know, how much they are getting starting fees. So, but
it'd be interesting to find out. You wonder, for instance, Judith Polgar gets more than people rated higher than her, like Anand or Shirov or someone. But she is a fighter, so but I'm thinking of her being the strongest woman of all time.
Yeah, well, she is she is a history, basically. She is, you don't have such a lady, you know, appearing too often. That's, it's amazing, of course. And the way how she plays, that's another beautiful things about her.
Yeah, she's got everything going for her.
Yeah.
Well, let's hope that she wins the knockout tournament in December and Gary has to play her in the semifinals.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
That would be exciting.
Yeah.
Anyway, Tony, do we have more questions for Lubos?
We do. We have a question from guest 1066 on chessclub.com. Mr. Kovalik, is there a way to optimize the time one spends studying chess to prepare for tournament play?
No. No. You have to put some hours into it. It's no matter what you do, is you have to spend a certain amount of time on game. I can tell you the fact that some young players who are prodigies and grow very, very fast and become very good players early. I noticed, for example, with Nigel Shaw, that he had gaping holes in his chess education and just missed, a lot of things from end games and other things. So you need to spend certain amount of time on the game, and there are no shortcuts.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. It's the horrible truth, but Lubos much, and I will keep telling people that as long as we live. Tony, more questions for Lubot.
Yes, we have a question from guest 1189. Question is, Kovalik, any plans for a book on your best games?
Well, that's an interesting question. I, of course, I always have plans about writing about my games. Some of my better games, well, other writers wrote about them. And the question is, I'm trying to find the idea how to present them, because there are already some ideas in the past, you know, with players presenting it in one form or another. So I am looking on something more original, and I'm sort of, you know, putting together some material. So it's in the plans. I don't know what happens later on, but it will be a good project to do.
One thought I have, Lubash, is you might, instead of doing it chronologically, do it based on attacking themes.
Well, there are many, many things, you know, what you should do or you can do. You know that I wrote a few books, maybe three or more, but I was also editor-in-chief of the RHM Press, and we published 30 books, and I work with great people like Bert Hagberg and De Soltis, and then work on openings with people like Norman Weichstein, who is now not involved in chess, you know, the way he was before, and other players. But that was that period marked. I had to give some ideas I have to give away to, you know, to make these opening books and other books possible. So that's the disadvantage of being an editor, and that you give away a lot of ideas. But there are still some which could be quite useful.
I can certainly see that. RHM books, as you know, Lubash, when Sidney Free died, his estate became difficult to deal with in terms of other publishers trying to reprint any RHM books.
Yeah.
And they wanted to sell them all or nothing, which is why a number of books to this day have not been reprinted. Your book, The Best Move by Horton Janssen, I think is a great book. I think he would agree with me.
This was a great book, yeah.
And How to Open a Chess Game is still a great book.
Yes.
But what I would suggest to you, is, because I'm a consultant to Dover Publications, is that whoever represents their estate now, you request the return of your rights to that book, the YKNZ. Because, you know, maybe perhaps we can get Dover to reprint it, even though it's indescriptive. Or, you know, maybe something can be worked out to turn it into algebraic. But it's certainly a book that deserves to be reprinted, because I've been going through it for a couple of weeks, and it's just, not only is it entertaining, but it's extremely instructive. And a lot of the games are such fantastic battles. Fortas draws some game that must have made him groggy for months afterwards, like some 95-book game, but he's been busted for like 12 hours or something.
Yeah.
And what I noticed is I don't think so many of the games from this tournament are famous, but they are many, many fierce battles.
Yeah, this is true. When the genre of writing tournament books always intrigued me, and this was always what I wanted to do, because it was exciting to read about old tournaments, Carlsbad 27 or whatever, you know.
Carlsbad 29.
Yeah, and so. It was great, and I thought the tournament book should be written like a reader, if the reader is reading it, that he feels like he's standing in the middle of the tournament hall and watches, you know, and observes the life and not only the games, but what the players are doing, you know, between the rounds and so on. So that was always, because you have stories, and if you have stories, whether it is a story in a game or if it is a story of a tragedy about some unlucky game or a long game, exhausting battle, you have a war between two guys. This is what is exciting. There are endless stories in would be in one tournament. So that's why that was always interesting for me to write about.
I just grabbed it open to page 215 in your book, and you're describing this game. It's actually an interesting little game, Sasanko Geller. And Sasanko needs one draw in his last two rounds, I think, to get a GM North. And he's been messing up after a great start. And now he's got white, but he's afraid. And you say here, right now I can only say that to play for a win is sometimes easier than to play for a draw. Sasanko got a space advantage very early in the game. Geller, on the other hand, took control of important squares on the queen side. This is a King's Indian in which Sasanko played a kind of, turned it into kind of a Banco system with knight c3 and never played c4. So, okay, once you get a space advantage, the general rule calls for an attack on one flank. In this case, Sasanko should have tried something, somehow, to attack the black king. What did he do instead? Well, he offered a draw. Promptly refused by Geller. And then you say, if something similar happened to me, I would really try to kill black's king. But Sasanko made a psychological mistake. He started exchanging pieces. All he wanted was a draw. But soon he realized he was not threatening anything, and Geller took advantage of this fact. Now Geller could play the game for 1,001 nights, hoping at the end Sasanko would not be able to cope with the pressure. But it did not take long before Sasanko blundered away the exchange and resigned. And you say he was very, very upset after the game and couldn't analyze with Geller afterwards, and Geller turns around, I think, says to you, maybe, is he really that upset?
Yeah, well.
But it's like a moral tale, even at the club level. If you need a half point to get something you want very, very badly, don't play like a wuss. Play a real game.
Yeah, but this is, we come back to where we started, basically, to the game Gurevich short. That's the same story, basically.
Right, so and you don't say it, but you, Nigel Short says this. He says that your opponent can smell the fear. And there's some crucial game, he beat Karpov from a strange position early in the Karpov match, and he could smell Karpov's fear. He suddenly knew Karpov was afraid in some middle game. And I think, you know what I'm saying at my level of average master expert play.
Yeah.
If somebody's afraid of you, you can sense it.
Well, this is clear. This is clear. This was always, or you could see, maybe it's not that you are afraid of somebody, but that you could feel the pressure, and that was quite noticeable when you played Bobby Fischer, for example, or when you played Kasparov. It was not so clear when you played Karpov. That was, you know, the physical sort of appearance was quite strong.
Instead of intimidating when they Kasparov's kind of a wide, well-built guy, and Fischer was just like a big guy when he was young.
Yeah, yeah. And you could see it was like a tornado coming to the game. He walked very quickly, of course, and just went down. And then you know, then from his physical movement and appearance, this kind of hurricane-like, you know, way was transmitted into the board, and then you could see the pressure there. So that was this was interesting. I was of course, very lucky to play all these great players, you know, during the few decades.
Oh, did you ever play Fischer?
I played. This was a very interesting game in Sousse and the Interzonal. It was Sicilian Neidorf, the poison pawn, and I sacrificed the knight because I sort of saw what was coming if I moved the knight away, so I thought maybe I should sacrifice the knight. Bobby insisted that we should change tables, that there was not enough light, so we got new table, we got many more lamps. And the game was really exciting, and it ended in a draw. It was a seesaw battle. The draw was quite short, but there was a lot of intensity, you know, between the moves.
Were you white in this game?
I was white.
Yeah.
But the funny story about the game was, of course, when I took a walk after the dinner, And I met Bobby on the street, and there was a street light. You could barely see anything, and he had this pocket chess set, and he said, "Well, I was winning if I played Bishop C5," and he started to show me. So at that moment, the light didn't really matter.
Was he right?
He was right. Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, now that's still a game to put in your book.
Well, of course, this is yeah. Exciting game, yes. And it was, you know, at that time, the variation was not fully analyzed. It was still possible to create some ideas on the board, and that was always exciting. I think that was the best. Think what could happen to our generation, that we were still able to create some ideas on the board and get some satisfaction. That, for example, these days you just push some buttons in computer and you have plenty of ideas, but we had to go, you know, deep down and find some during the play.
Very interesting. Yeah, they seem to want to do all the creative work before they come to the board now. Or have Fritz do it. Tony, do we have more questions for Lubash? We've got about 5 minutes left.
We do. We have a couple questions. We have a question from Hangin. Hangin writes in, were you a second to Bobby Fischer during the 1972 World Championship match?
Yes, officially I was his bowling coach. Unofficially, I think it started in during the game 13. That was the Alekhine defense. That basically he asked me to work with him, and I don't know, they had some disagreement with Bill Lombardi, so. From game 13, I basically worked with Bobby till the end, and I think he never said thank you. That was not his style, but he did in a very subtle way. Right after he learned that he won the world championship, he picked up Chess Life and started to play over. Two of my games, one was with Reshevsky and the other was against Larry Kaufman. And we were telling him, Bobby, what you are doing? You know, it's just we celebrate. You are the new world champion. He said, no, these are very interesting games. And then the other thing what he did was that he gave me the first interview after the match. He let, for example, Brett Darak and Harry Benson from Life magazine wait outside of his villa. And we were taping this interview. We were like little boys where he wanted to be sure that everything is there. So after each question and answer, he would stop the tape recorder and look if we taped it correctly and so on.
Where was this interview published?
This was a radio interview. It was for the Voice of America, and shortly after we started, there was a man from the U.S. Embassy who appeared at the door, and he said that he has a telegram from President Nixon. And Bobby didn't want to let him in, so eventually I convinced him that he should, you know, allow this man to come in. And then what I did was that I asked Bobby to read the telegram, you know, and it, you know, it went into the interview. And it is now part of the Hall of Fame.
Now, wait, has this interview been preserved? Was it recorded?
Yes, of course, I have the tape, the only tape. I gave the Hall of Fame a small part where Bobby reads the telegram from President Nixon.
Have you thought about publishing this interview? I mean, you own it. Maybe if you publish it.
Well, it's too much work.
Lubash, we have to talk sometime, because I think you could, if you have a tape, you could even produce copies of the tape and legitimately sell copies of this interview with Fisher from 1972. And think it over, Lubash. This is history.
You are, Fred, you are too commercially oriented.
That's why I have been self-employed for 30, 35 years, Lubash.
No, it was a pleasure. It was, I think we had a great time with Bobby doing this interview. And it's something personal, I like to keep, but
well, someday you might write an article about it and include significant answers to interesting questions. Right. That would be worthwhile. Oh, and get paid for it.
So you are not that commercially oriented.
Right. Okay. I'm not that commercially oriented.
All right.
I think we've run out of time. But Lubash, I really enjoyed this interview and the question and answer. And I really would like to have you come back on again, maybe in 5 or 6 months or so. You think that would be possible?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me, and give me a call when you feel like it.
Oh, no, I certainly will. Now, this has been fascinating, and I'll probably ask you more about what he said on that tape, because, you're telling us something that many of us didn't know, that you got a real interesting interview from him right after he won the title. Probably there are some interesting statements by him there.
But it was heard all over the world. You know,
but at that time, people weren't sitting around recording things like they are now.
Ah, okay.
Remember, that was then. This is now.
But you know, now you should not really record music on the internet.
I know, and nobody should record my show, and I'm sure Tony, nobody does. But if anybody recorded the first Pandolfini show, please send us a copy, and we'll. We lost that one. But
the second one.
Lubash.
Okay.
Lubash, yours is playing again in about 11:05 or 11:10 tonight, and at 12 noon tomorrow there'll be a replay of our interview if you would like to hear it or tell any of your friends about it.
I don't read my books. I don't listen to my interviews.
Well, you're missing out on something because you're very good. Anyway, thank you again very much for appearing on the show.
Okay, you're welcome.
Thanks, as always, to my producer, Matthew Passy, and to everyone who helps spread the word about the show, telling your friends, writing positive reviews on podcast platforms. All of that stuff helps. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at BennyFishel1. Join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can find the link on the website, and we are back in action on Instagram, at Perpetual Chess, sharing a weekly clip from the podcast. So follow us over there as well. But of course, the main purpose of these credits is to thank everyone who makes the show possible by their financial support. Without you all, Perpetual Chess would have ceased to exist a long time ago. And for that, I am forever grateful and work to continually improve and expand the offerings from Perpetual Chess. So without further ado, I would like to give extra special thanks to the following people and entities. Chessable.com, David Lazarus of LazmanChess.com, Quality Chess Books, The Capital City Chess Club, The Abysmal Deaths of Chess Blog, Adapta Interactive Web Designs and Services, The Apprentice Twitch Channel, Andrew Alharji, Andrew Bach, Aniti Deer,
Boston Clough, Benjamin Porteau, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, the Charlotte Chess Center, the Chess Central's Chess Blog, ChessMood.com, Chris Flanagan, Chris Lott, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel He, Danny Davidson, David Schreiber, Derek Jones, I am Dimitri Schneider, I am Eric Rosen, Eric Tam, Ewan Richardson, Farhan Thawar, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Glenn Downing, Greg Harfs, Greg Shahadi, Gregory Gulick, Guvin Manet, James Kennedy, Jeff Martins, and Jens Green, Jeremy Nielsen, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John Cromarty, John MacArthur, Kelly Palmer, Kevin O'Callaghan, King Selt, Lucio Casada Silva, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, Matthew Feeney, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mike Zelazny, Mr. Mike Shahadi, the famous Mr. Dodgy, the Nerdnaze Twitch channel, Peter Sodi, the Playmore Chess Academy of the Hampton Chess Club, Reuven Fisher, the Seattle Chess Club, Shane Unger, Stephen Kelty, Stephen Martinez, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryan of StrongChess.com, Todd Kennedy, the Vintage Patzers, which is a Chess.com improver group, Wayne Beam, William Hogarth, Aaron Waffler, Ace Viega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, FM Andre Tarakov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Barry Hessian, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brett Howard Lynn, Brian Mullis, Bruce Scott, Brian Tillis of Palm Beach Chess, Chad Hilton, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Chabri, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, a.k.a. Chess Explain, Coach J's Chess Academy, Corey Budson, Costa Corus, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Saylor, David Bleskacek, David Brown, David Hamblin, David Cramley, Dalen Shelton, Dennis Parrish, Dirk Decker, FM Donnie Ariel, Douglas Matthew, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Emmanuel Langlois Robitaille, Ethan Smith, Hallelujah Cat, Ian Mason, Indrik Ryland, Felipe Melo Pereira, Fox Valley Chess Club, Francis Letart Lavoie, Dr. Frank Tortoise, Frank Zananis, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vandervelt, Gene Stewart, Gerard Barta, Giovanni Russo, Hans Schutt, Harish Srinivasan, Howard Vihan, Jacob Kovacs, Jacob Turan, Jacques Perry, James Espinwall, James Banastia, James Muir, Jason Willem, J.G. Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jim Ratliff, John Tully, Juan Almaguer, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Slater, John Tully, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, WGM Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, Grandmaster Josh Friedel, I am Kare Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, Kevin Boyce, Kevin Pryor, Kior Gada of the Lakeshore Chess Club, I am Kostya Kavutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Reiforth, Laura Belyovsky, Macaulay Peterson, Mark Miller, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matthew Passy, Matthew Tedesco, Matthias Plock, the Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Allard, Michael Hudson, Miguel Araspidi, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Salon, Neil Bruce, Nigmat Malajanov, Nicholas Isabel, Olaf Mueller Michaels, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hallenbach, Robert Tichy, Robert Turner, Rory Coleman, Rory Yearwood, Ryan Berg, the Say Chess YouTube channel, Scott Doherty, Scott McKinnon, Sebastian Finsterwater, Walder, Shane Unger, the Silver Knights in Richmond, Stefan Roller, WGM Tatia Vabrahamian, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Tom Edsel, Tomas Komanich, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Vishnu Srikumar, William H. Brock, William Juniper, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, and of course, Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks for listening, everyone. We will be back next week with another episode of Perpetual Chess.
Podcast Network.
I'm Victoria Cash. Thanks for calling the Lucky Land Hotline. If you feel like you do the same thing every day, press 1. If you're ready to have some serious fun for the chance to redeem some serious prizes, press 2. We heard you loud and clear. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com right now and play over 100 social casino-style games for free. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.